Sexual healing, what does that mean? What I'm talking about is the consequences of the gender roles that we're taught in our society, and the pure gender roles that the culture gives us, and how those can be pathological for both men and women, and how the stereotypical gender roles that males and females play may be lead to difficulties, problems, and pathologies of one sort or another. And this is also true in marriage, out of marriage, and the way that men and women relate to one another. There's also healing in terms of physical healing. And talking about male aggression, cultures have tried things like castration of men who tend to be especially aggressive. Or looking for cultural alternatives or ways to socialize the aggression into some socially beneficial channels, like becoming samurai warriors. there's that Oriental tradition with the martial arts that male tendency to react to frustration or trying circumstances in daily life with aggressive, violent responses can be socially useful, depending on how closely it's socialized and encapsulated and trained, so that it comes out when it's supposed to. The Japanese would go, and I don't know, maybe you've seen some samurai pictures, movies, but the idea is that you take males that don't seem to be able to, they have this extra dose of energy, and then and take them and school them in traditions, not just fighting traditions or techniques of fighting, but educate their minds too and their brains, and make them into people that can use this their particular gift for socially useful things. Until, of course, there's some. What usually happens, of course, is that you've got these highly trained instruments of violence, and then there's no outlet for them, and so because of social change of one sort or another, so they have to find other ones. That's sort of what happened to samurai. They became sort of like soldiers of war, soldiers of fortune. And then there's treatment also, hormone treatment. There's psychosurgery that's used for some people as ways of cutting the nerves that connect behavior and emotion as a way of controlling violent responses. I want to just emphasize,
Did we talk about the causes of this aggression, where this came from?
Well, those were the articles that I wanted you to read. I can. The article by Faust talks about the influence of different hormones in the development of males and females. Testosterone is the hormone that tends to give men more of this energy or sexual energy, and makes for some differences because the males and females have different doses of that. Makes for more problems that males have in controlling their behaviors on a daily basis. I think there's really some good evidence in this way, or along this line, and this is my own idea after reading a lot of this literature, that if you chart the temperature variations in males on a daily basis and a weekly basis, there's major ups and downs.
You mean actually body temperature?
Yeah, body temperature. And, taking temperatures is a way that women tend to tell when they're ovulating, or ways of monitoring their own bodily processes. But the women's temperatures go on a monthly cycle, whereas the male's body temperatures go on with a lot more variation just in a daily ups and downs. And that we recognize that when women have the greatest amount of testosterone in their blood system is the time that has come to be labeled as a disease, P PMT, premenstrual tension. And it's actually been used as a defense in court for women's violence, murder and assault. And so if you assume that males have the same thing on only on a daily basis, then you know what prevents males coming to court and saying, you know, the same thing, I had PMT only, you know, on a daily basis. So, and Faust also points out, and this is where you have to make the jump, you know, from the biology to the cultural or personal habits, that that men seem to seek out mechanisms to control themselves and to release tension a lot more than women do. And she uses the example of alcohol. Like the man comes home from work and, you know, mixes up a quart of martinis to get him, you know, in a place where he can start thinking and handling himself at home. The in men's jobs that are men, the kinds of jobs men have that are especially tension provoking in relationship to other people, like for example being a cop, let's say. There's a lot of, you know, a cop goes around in his daily life and people swear at him and you know, flip him off, things like that. And so there's all, you know, and cops have this, because they're men generally, you have a lot of reaction that, you know, like cops beat up people and tend to take care of disrespect that showed them through violent mechanisms or means. Well, again, if we socialized or looked at this as being a real problem and built into our culture ways of channeling this aggression or releasing it in ways that weren't socially so dysfunctional, we might have some differences. And I was thinking specifically of the articles I read about the police in Japan. And in Japan, when a cop goes on duty, this is in Tokyo, and I don't know whether this is a, you know, something they just say they do or they have but it's a requirement that before they go on duty, they spend an hour in a martial arts kind of thing, you know, whatever they've chosen, as a way of getting themselves, you know, ready to go out on the job. And then when they come off the job, they're required to take an hour in something like flower arranging. As a way of mellowing them out and getting them ready to, you know, get off their job and back into life again. And the tremendous divorce, alcoholism, suicide rate, and everything else of cops in this country is a real problem, you know. And I think it's because we don't make those distinctions between on the job and off the job, and the tensions are carried over from one to the next.
I don't see many of them getting DUIs either.
What's that?
Cops. We'll see them in the education classes with the rest of the people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's hard for them to even have a problem with alcohol.
Yeah. It's very difficult, you know, some people have said it's very difficult to find a cop that hasn't been divorced. You know, the divorce rate is it's so high that it's, that it just seems to be an occupational hazard. Well, one of the things then what I'm getting at and what I want to get to is looking at how men and women in their general gender roles support one another in these kinds of pathologies that we're talking about. And it's always a danger for, you know, a man like me to say that a lot of the unwanted behaviors or socially destructive behaviors that men do may be supported to some extent by the gender roles that women are playing. Because it's obviously not the women that take the brunt of the social destructive activity. I mean, it's obviously not the men that take the brunt of the socially destructive activity. So, for example, when people go out and study violence in the family, like you were talking about before, like wife battering, they find that there are certain kinds of families and certain gender role relationships between men and women in those families that tend to produce or are conducive to violence. And then somebody says, well, yeah, I mean, women are just as responsible as men. And at one level, we can talk about that. But the other level is saying, yeah, violence shouldn't be there anyway. I mean, even though the woman may provoke this, and we could find examples of that, it's still not good that somebody beats her up. I mean, that should be the first thing that's prevented, rather than, you know, just sort of saying, well, let's deal with the family as a system and see how that comes out. we just ought to say violence is not appropriate ever, and begin there. So in talking, you see the danger I'm getting at, or what I'm trying to talk about, is that it's difficult for women to hear that they have some responsibilities in this area when in fact they take the brunt of the fact that it's that it occurs.
What kind of responsibilities do you mean?
Well, I want to play a tape, the one that I asked you to listen to that I'm sure nobody listened to, by Ray McKeever, because I think it's really important getting at this question. So I wanted to play it first, just a section off this tape. So, see if you can listen.
Yeah, and I would just get very, I don't even want to say anything about the masculine. The two forms of power that I mentioned, one is expressive power, and the other is what he calls a masculine validating power. Maybe a simple example of that would be what you do.
Maybe I better introduce what he's talking about. On this tape, it's called Men in Power. And what he's talking about is how the dependency of men on women for an expression of their emotional side creates the circumstances where men oppress women. And he's saying this, he gives some specific examples of this. One of them, being that men seek out women as a refuge from their own world. Like the man goes out, works in a job that's highly competitive, this might be an example. And so he looks for an escape from that. So he goes home, his wife is there, his girlfriend is there to cool him out. And to nurture and give him emotional support. And a lot of men look to women for that. A lot of men, maybe 99.9% of men, because where else are they going to get that emotional support and nurturance if not from women? Another example would be the fact that a man can't express himself emotionally except having a woman express those emotions for him. So in other words, the man says, is in some kind of a state where he may be depressed, something else. Anyway, he's having trouble with his emotions. And then the woman says, well, you feel this way, you feel that way, and let me comfort you and take care of you or something like that. So the man seeks out women to express his emotions or to give voice to his emotions. And then another example would be, the one he's just talking about here is where men use women as a means of validating themselves to other men. And I wanted to reiterate those two concepts of epidiectic and epigamic behavior, so that the kind of wife or the attractiveness of a girlfriend or something like that, men will use that in terms of their own ranking of each other. And it's, in other words, we do rank people in society according to their erotic vibrations, or whatever. And we say that this person is number one or number 10 or something, and then we rank people on down that way. And I'm sure that's just both men and women. So in competition, men compete for women in this respect. And also then women become an object in this sense. And are maybe oppressed or men may seek to dominate women for that reason. And then the last way is that men seek out women to validate their masculinity. So he uses the example of, like, would there be the intensity of football and basketball and so on if there weren't women, cheerleaders and saying, yeah, go to it, Or the idea that that men can be good providers, let's say, and give their families lots of goods and cars and TVs and everything like that. And then the woman validates that role and says, my husband is a good provider. Where how much of this masculine behavior that may be harmful to men is validated by women? And how much of it would exist if women weren't there to say, you're really great, my man, kind of thing. So that's kind of, and then this part of the tape is his summary of what he sees to be the consequences and what may be done about it.
It's said, If he could put the light bulb in some ways, his masculine, you could validate his masculine. Say, oh, yes, 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 go ahead and do that. And the other one I thought it was, you know, what would football, would there be football or basketball? That's an extreme example. But, you know, would it all be worth it if there wasn't somebody saying, oh, yeah, yeah, that's great, yeah, that's not more, and all that kind of stuff. There, I'm sure it's much more complex than that. But in some, I know what it feels like more than I can think of immediate examples. To have women validate my masculinity in sort of just subtle ways. In connection with those two forms of power, I think at least one of the main issues for me, or for the whole structure of that power setup, is that men fear that women will withhold these, what I call, identity-assuring powers. And this leads men to continually have to reassert their power over women, to keep women in those kind of roles of being emotional, and assuring our emotionality, of validating our masculinity. And so if we're going to try to change the situation, I mean, who wants to change it? You know, we've got to give up all these things. So I think that's what, that stands in the way of, one of the things that stands in the way of change. And as I already said, in particular, I think in connection with women, although we've said much more about this here, doing that kind of thing places an incredibly heavy burden on women, which even though women go ahead and do that for the sake of kind of their own identity, being as much as they can, given the setup, women don't really want to hold these powers over men. They want some more sense of mutuality. Okay, how to change all this?
How to change all this? I wanted to emphasize what he just said, because I wanted to get back to that again. Do women want to give up these roles? In the same way, do men want to give up their roles? If that's the major validating way that we, of our gender roles, then what is left if we don't have that to do anymore? In other words, if men don't need women any longer for emotional nurturance and support, what are women going to do in the relationship with men? And where this gets into the fairy tale that I left you with last time is that I think a lot of this comes from the male's relationship to his mother. And that's where he learns that women give him support and emotional sustenance and all those sorts of things and nurturance.
Is this the reality of most men you know? I'm just curious because...
Yeah, I think men have... Well, can men do this for one another?
Well, I'm asking you a question, though, but I mean, is this the reality for most men, that they get most of this from women? Is this still the case?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
And I think this... Did you read this thing here?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty right on. I would... You know, anybody else can say that. Say what they want to, but it usually takes a few beers, and you know, the absence of women, and for men to start relating to one another. You know, I mean, it's difficult to not only that, but if you think of so many settings where the presence of women there mellow out the relationships among men, that women facilitate a lot of normal interaction among men that we would say is, you know, like a socially acceptable level. On this tape, Dan Erlander gives the example of the ministry, where until women were ordained and you just had men in the ministry, you had a highly competitive thing. And men had trouble talking with one another and not ranking one another, like in terms of how many members they have in their church and how much of a contributions people give and things like that. And when women start being ordained, all of a sudden there's a switch over, and so men start being concerned more about nurturing and emotional relationships within the church, support groups, healing, you know, and all those sorts of things.
Strikes me that might be a prime example in a lot of ways of a woman in a nurturing role being the wife of a clergy person.
Mm-hmm.
And right. How people see that.
Right.
And then if unless you have an ordained woman, what's her husband doing? The chances are good he's a pastor too. Or, I mean, it's just a thought. I grew up with that, and something that strikes me a lot more and more.
In my own profession, there's women sociologists have written about their roles at conventions. You know, so men get together at a convention, and they say, like, how many articles, books have you written? You know, how many book reviews? You know, this and, you know, and it's all like their career and everything. So conventions are also nice places just to let out tension and from, you know, one's daily life and to just sort of separate oneself from one's everyday affairs and have a good time. And so men at conventions look to women to have good times. although, you know, that's not totally true. But there's that tendency for women to play that role. What?
I just have a couple of suggestions based on my own experience. One is, I thought of when I sang the line of the song from the No Feeling Tunes, there is a little takeoff on the Beatles, where it says, won't you help me if you can? And then I just said, I'm feeling down and out of touch. And I do appreciate you being around so very much. And the thought that I had connection with that little interlude was that I feel like I, in the past, have been able to eke that out with women, and that brings women in to kind of help me out. Kind of a vulnerable, open statement. I think men need to learn how to make that statement. Although I've got a long ways to go with it, to do that in one-to-one situations with men, which I find even more scary than doing it in a group with men. So I suggest, you know, the group is an important experience for me, just some sort of just commitment to getting together regularly. And first of all, I suppose you'd have to acknowledge that these things are true. If you don't want to acknowledge that, that's called consciousness raising. And the second is to be willing to work and support each other through those kinds of things. And that's really one of the reasons that I feel like the men's group here at Holden is just really valuable for me and for a lot of others. It feels chancy, but I think men need to be apart from women to do a lot of that work. And I've forgotten the David Steinberg poem, but he has a wonderful poem about this. And the poem ends something like, you know, does this mean I want to separate myself from women? And the answer is, no, I don't want to separate myself from women, but I do need to work apart from women. So in men's work, men need to recover the ability to recognize and express emotions apart from women. And secondly, men need to learn how to validate each other so as to decrease reliance on women. I mean, I think men, we validate each other some ways, but I don't know how straightforward it is. Oh, excuse me. But I don't know, this is, I never have enough heart-to-heart validation in my life.
Heart-to-heart validation. You see, the way that men normally validate one another is with these epidiactic behaviors, the traditional ones. And I think probably one of the worst pathological or best pathological examples, depending on how one looks at it, one can find these days is probably the fraternity at a college. The fraternity movement almost died out in the 60s because of the opposition to the Vietnam War and the feeling that violence and aggression by males was just out of hand. And then men started searching for their female or feminine side, and the fraternity didn't fit in very well with that. And so men especially sought out that side from other women, getting together with other women, finding out what women were about, and realizing that they had some of these same emotions and feelings inside of them. And so men started, you know, like going out to the ocean side, writing poetry, letting more of their artistic side come out, getting into nurturing relationships and communicating relationships. But this, you see how this dependency on women is still there for this then? And how does the man give back to the woman? And this is where the traditional gender roles fit in, because the man says, what can I do for you? Well, I'll fix your house. You know, I'll change your light bulb. And they may even get into generally typical female things like, I'll do your cooking for you. You know, I'll babysit for you. I'll, do anything else. But that's the point is that what the woman wants in return? You know, in those, no. You know, the idea is that she would like some kind of emotional support and nurturance back again. But that men have difficulty doing that. And some people would say, as long as those traditional gender roles are played out like that, the man is not going to be able to get over his own sense of incompleteness in this area. When it comes to nurturing and emotional support and so on, and validation of masculinity, men can't possibly come up to where women are at this point. And they feel inferior to women in this respect. So as Ray McKeever is saying here, maybe men need to separate, to go off, and start taking care of these problems on their own. Now, this is, of course, what the feminist movement did. Can women live without men? You know, or do they need men to fill up their psyche, to give them identity, and traditional women's roles were as an extension of a male's identity, playing the role of support and dependency to a male's animus, so to speak, his ideas about himself and his role in the world. So women have gone through this route, you know, of separating themselves, finding out who they are, and can they exist and do these things for one another and get some identity apart from men. And so what he's saying is, you know, do you see how threatening that is to men? Because men say, you mean women don't need me? You know, what is my role in life then? So they try to make women need them. And by doing these things like, you know, I'll fix your house for you, you know, or whatever. And so women start learning to do these things on their own. And then women start taking over traditional men's jobs. And then men say, well, where am I in this? You know? And that's where he's saying that some people would suggest the pathology comes in. The tightly gender separated family is where you find most of the violence. You know, where the man asserts himself through violent means and the woman in her traditional passive role validates herself by being on the end of the kind of oppression and violence that occurs. And she, of course, then the therapy comes in trying to free her from playing that role. But also then it has to be aimed at the man too, freeing him from playing his traditional role. Last time I left you with this fairy tale. And I don't know if you remember it or whether you did much reflection on it. But it's a fairy tale that Robert Bly resurrected from someplace. I don't know what book he got it out of. But the idea that the man goes out alone to try to discover, you know, you remember what happens? They bucket out this pond and here's this ugly, hairy kind of semi-monster at the bottom of this thing. Well, that usually is symbolic in fairy tales for being the aggressive, masculine, fearful type of thing that's at the basis of our psyche, and especially a man's psyche. So getting in touch with that and finding what Robert Bly calls it, the wild man. But you remember what happens, we can talk about the sight of men as long as it's in a cage. You know, as long as it's sitting there in the courtyard and we can sort of examine it and stand back and not really have contact with it, direct contact with it. And we can hypothesize about it and so on. But to actually have that free and living in a male or in a alongside a male in or part of his psyche is something that's pretty scary. And he suggests then that with the story of the 8-year-old boy who loses his ball and goes into the cage, and he can't get his ball back again unless he lets the monster out. And the idea of the golden sphere, the golden ball, is the sense of one's wholeness, where one has their life together. And it's true that males, I think a lot of males I've talked to say that this happens like around 8 years old, that all of a sudden the male starts not fitting in with things. This is the age where teachers first start noticing that little boys, you know, start messing up in school. They don't sit still. They run around. They violate the rules. That you know, where if the boy doesn't lose it, then by the time they're in high school, they've totally lost it. The sense of who they are and where they fit in. That school doesn't seem to be the ideal place for men to find themselves as adults. In other words, we put people through a school system as a way of coming out the other end as full-fledged adults. That doesn't seem to work for males in our society. School, the more we've stuck males in school, the worse things have gotten, the higher delinquency rates have gotten, the higher rates of violence.
You're saying that's much more true for the males than for the females.
Yeah. I'm saying it's because this image that is not looked at, cultivated, or whatever, this basis of the male psyche, this sense of unbounded energy, fearful energy. On this tape, there's other sections where men are talking, and it becomes clear that, and most men have had this experience too, of being fearful of other men. And you really see this with black males in especially urban areas. They have really high blood pressure. And a lot of that is due to the fact that they walk around not knowing what's going to jump out at them at any time to attack them. You know, they have to have really, much more so than white middle class males, they have to have a rough exterior, you know, something to protect them, and they have to worry about constantly being attacked. Men have experienced this with other men. You know, you don't know when you're going to get attacked. Again, women come in as sort of, you know, like a refuge from this.
I think women feel that too. Just
with other men or with women?
With other men.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of being that fear of being attacked. You know.
Right. Mm. I think you're right.
I'm not afraid of women, but I'm afraid of men.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the same true as where men are, too.
Yeah.
Not in seventh grade. Seventh grade is a bit different. Women could attack you just as well as men. Beat the hell out of you, too.
But I remember, you know, like, you know, just the seventh grade was, you know, when you come out of the nice, like, homey environment of a single teacher schoolroom, and then you go into this factory called a school, that's the seventh grade, and it's so much more impersonal, and you don't have the kinds of relationships that allow you to treat one another on a subjective, understanding, individualistic basis that's so much more possible in like a one teacher schoolroom. That in the seventh grade, all of a sudden, men were, you know, boys are fighting all the time. I mean, and not the kind of fighting where it just breaks out, you know, and somebody hits somebody and somebody hits somebody back, but where there's actually a pecking order that begins, you know, to say, I'll meet you after school, and if you're not there, then, you know, you're lowered in the pecking order. And so, you know, men start doing this. And I always thought it was funny because my junior high school was a really big one, but it crossed class, and so you had the Flatlands kids. They were mostly working class kids and minority kids. And then you had the Hill kids that came from rather well-to-do homes. And so the kids from off the Hill, their form of male competition was taking band and then challenging, you know, seats, you know, in the band, like first chair, second chair. So after school here, all the upper middle class kids were, you know, playing their trumpets and everything, trying to best one another and move up and down. And there was like 20 challenges a day after school. And the working class kids were down behind the boys' club, you know, doing the same thing, only in a more physical way.
Now, I don't know if that would be true just with the males. I mean, my association with girls on a counseling basis was nothing was worse than the fights that the girls would get into.
Uh-huh.
And they would detain them for weeks on end, you know, and they'd come back. Well, the boys could fight and forget
them. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard women say that. There's a real competitive spirit, subtle.
Well, it's probably over males that they're.
Well, that may be true too, but I think we also have to make a distinction constantly that when we're talking about masculine and feminine, you know, like with a capital M and a capital F, it doesn't necessarily mean real men and women are this way. You know, I mean, there's obviously a mixture, and we can talk about men getting in touch with their feminine side and women with their masculine side, you know, and so on. Oh, okay, so I was talking about the fairy tale. And if you remember that one of the key elements of the fairy tale was that when the little boy says, I can't open the cage because I don't know where the key is, the answer was, well, the key is under your mother's pillow. And so this is the idea that a boy gets his freedom from breaking himself off from the relationship with his mother. And as long as that apparently dominates himself or his life, he won't be or have difficulty getting in touch with his truly masculine side. And one other interpretation is that it's the that to find one's true identity, for a male to find his true identity, he can't find it from women or he can't find it from his mother. That it has to be from the community of males and other teachings and so on.
Is the monster the true identity, or why is it?
It's the
monster seems so bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's the scary thing, you know, that we have to control in so many ways because it's scary if it gets loose. You know, it can cause a lot of problems and damage and destruction. It may be that side of us that sort of this demonic force you know, if we let ourselves go. Another way of coming out, I was reading this article by Rita Mae Brown. Maybe you've read some. She's a pretty well-known author. She wrote Ruby Fruit Jungle, and lately she was in the papers because she had a tremendous breakup with her girlfriend, who was a tennis player. But she was saying, you know, that she has a lot of male friends, and she was saying why she likes males and why she likes male friends in addition to female friends. And what she was pointing out were some of the things that men are like that she finds enjoyable. And I think some of those things were kind of getting at what this basic thing is. And she pointed out, for example, that men are much more vocal and let, you know, their feelings of anger and frustration and hostility be known. You know, so that rather than just take it in and live with it, you know, the man says, well, I'm not going to take that lying down. I'm going to, you know, say something. And if I feel that I've been wronged, I'm going to come back at that person and let them know that. Another thing was, I thought it was kind of interesting because I think it's true too, is that women find it much easier just to sit around and talk, you know, to have tea or whatever and converse. Whereas men like to be doing something while they're talking. You know, repairing, planting bushes, jogging, fishing, you know, usually combine activities. And that's nice too. But it has to do with recognizing a sort of a hidden side that's been covered up. And if you look at the social changes that have taken place in our society in the last, since industrialization, men have been further and further removed from nurturing relationships in the home and for contact with young males. And so it's, a male grows up, you know, not having a lot of understanding, and this will vary, of course, from place to place within our culture, and because experiences are different. But contact with adult men in a nurturing, emotional, supportive way is something a lot of boys never get. Other, you know, primitive tribes, we call primitive tribes, have these initiation rites of males into manhood. And the man goes, or the boy goes off with other men and is, and gets nurturance, support, and is taught to depend on other men for these kinds of needs. Now, just like, you see, there's two sides of it. Just like men have had to say, you know, can women get along without me? I mean, can they do everything for themselves? You know, the answer is yes. Likewise, will women say, or have to make this decision, if men withdraw from women for these needs, and they find that they don't need women necessarily, then will that be threatening to women? Well, definitely it's going to be threatening to some women who see their primary roles, like mothers, you know, taking care of their sons and having their sons dependent upon them for this. And, you know, for women to give up this with their sons may be something that a lot of women desire, you know, because they don't want the responsibility totally on themselves. But where are they going to shift the responsibility to? You know, where are the men that will take this responsibility? And that's where we're caught right now in our sociocultural context of not having that.
Yeah. Who says yes to this? Can women get along without men? I mean, I don't know if I believe that or not. I'm in denial.
I say yes. What was an old saying? I remember seeing on March something. This is a little raggle, but it said that women need men like a fish needs a bicycle. Have you ever heard that? I just, that came to mind.
If you need someone in such a desperate sense, maybe you can't love them, but if you find out that, yeah, I'm self-sufficient and my life is whole apart from that, then you have something awesome to offer that relationship, and it can be that, then you can need it in a more legitimate, wonderful way.
I hear all this, but I just had difficulty believing.
But one of the things is, you know, lots of us live our lives going along with what's been taught us and all of that, and we never know whether it's really us or what we were sort of socialized and told was right or wrong. And so there's a lot of experiences we have in growing up where we give up those things. And then we come back and end up doing the same thing, only this time it was our choice. It's like a lot of people leave the church for that reason. You know, they're raised in the church, they go to Sunday school, and their parents are really active and all that. And then they go away to college or something and they say, is it me, you know, or do I want this thing, or is it just that my parents told me I needed it? And so they leave the church, and then after a while they come back and end up doing the same thing again, only this time it was their choice. But, you know, and that really is a shorthand way, you know, putting out a lot of details.
I'm not saying just a relation between a man and a woman, which we are talking about, but another person to have intimacy with on a level that we don't have with anybody else. You know,
yeah.
But I think that's a need.
Sure. Okay. Now, see, this is the ambivalence, and this is what he was talking about. You know, do men want to give this up? Do women want to give this up? To use an example, when I use the term gender pathology, what I'm talking about is how living out traditional gender roles may be really unhealthy for people, like in a marriage or in a relationship. Now, take the example where the man is relates to his wife like a son to a mother, you know, where he's dependent on her for just like, you know, cooking, emotional support, and all those sorts of things, and he sort of goes off and does his own thing, you know. Pretty soon, you know, what happens in a marriage like that is that, pretty soon, sooner or later anyway, is that the woman says, you know, the man starts rebelling against this, just like he rebelled against his mother, you know, and starts not liking the fact that this woman, that he's totally dependent on this woman. So he begins withdrawing. Well, the woman, what happens to her then when the man's withdrawing is that she comes closer. Mm-hmm. You know, as he's going this way, she's, you know, and then he sees that as more and more oppression. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, eventually they get a divorce. You know. And again, sure, I can't say what happens. But then there's the other side too. What about the man who is completely dependent, or independent, excuse me, completely independent? And here's a case I was reading about where a man, he was a doctor, and his practice started suffering because he made a horrible error and he was sued for malpractice. And he had thought of himself in this very independent male way of being infallible, totally in control, never having to seek support or getting anything from anybody else. And so when his practice started suffering this way, it was a real blow to his ego. Well, his wife had adjusted to that fact that he was playing out this independent role, and so she was just, you know, she would give dinner parties, but not really relate to him in any way or another. So now he gets to a point in his life where he really needs that from his wife. And he doesn't know how to ask for it, and she doesn't know how to give it. And so they start having trouble. Because the more that he asks for it, the more she says, why now? You know, I mean, really, come on, grow up. So it works, you know, like what you're saying, you can see that it works both ways. And so it's not just an easy answer, you know, to say. But the example I gave, the doctor, he couldn't get this from other men either. You know, because it would, if men go to other men and say, I'm weak, I need support, I'm having trouble, that's not epidiectic. You know, that's the opposite. Mm-hmm. That's a way to lower yourself in the eyes of other men.
George?
Yeah?
A question about the story that you just said before this one about the man who ended up getting the divorce because he felt depressed, etc., because of another marriage. What was the beginning of that story? Was there a love relationship even in the beginning?
Well, there, I don't know.
Would there have likely been, or would it always have been a mother need?
Well, yeah. I'm saying that's probably the complementary roles. That's probably the reason they got together in the first place. That, you know, but love, you know, that's something I wanted to talk about on Thursday. Yeah.
In relation to what John said about it hurts to say, for a woman to say, but I don't need a man, since he doesn't want to be celibate. But you have to realize that in our culture too, if a woman has to say, I need a man, then she's in a pretty poor position. Because in our culture, it's usually not the woman that gets to make the decision if she's going to be married or not. First place, just biologically, there's more women than there are males. And secondly, our culture is not considered appropriate for the woman to be the aggressor and to initiate the marriage and child. And like Kathy was saying, after a divorce, so that would put you in a pretty desperate situation if you had to say, I need a man, that you couldn't find wholeness or happiness without.
But I'm still saying I need a woman.
So yeah, but you were saying it hurt to have a woman say, I don't need a man.
Right, but I'm saying the same thing a woman said. You know?
I'm just saying why it would be difficult for a woman to have to.
But you don't think it's difficult for a man to have to say that he needs a woman? You think it's easier in our culture, is that what you say, for a man?
Yeah, because you, our culture, permits you to be the initiator.
Which I don't want to assume the rule of, but...
No, but that's just the way it is, I mean, right. At this time. And there's also more women than there are men. That's a biological factor present in society.
I think it can make a big difference in some ways. In what terms we're talking, if you're talking about personally, one-on-one, I need a man or I need a woman, or if you're talking in general, women need men and men need women. So I think I can say, I believe we do need each other in the big general overall picture, okay? Well, and then I think choice becomes a big key word there, because whether you're feeling personally like women can do without men in general, or you're feeling personally like I don't need a man, so to speak, that's your choice. personally, I think I, my past, I'd say especially 7 years or so, if I took men out of the picture, it'd be very lonely. And I don't mean just intimate personal relationships, I mean in general, because I'm coming from where, and some of your comments from that lady struck me, because most of my close friends
what lady?
Have been men.
Huh? What lady?
I think you said Brown, maybe?
Oh, maybe. Brown. Yeah. She's a woman.
Oh, I said man?
No.
What lady?
I think she would not run to herself to call a lady.
Okay, that's female. And
or woman.
So there I have found it's apparently been my choice to either seek out or be receptive to close relationships with men rather than women. And I'm more comfortable with that. I'm glad to have that choice.
Okay. Can I say that the archetypal images of males and females that we come from, that we assume are embedded in our psyche someplace, have to be recognized. And the fact is that women do attract men. You know, that is part of their archetypal image. And they play out this, so they find it easy to do, even without even trying. But they're very concerned about, in general, about the way they look, the way they dress, makeup, you know, these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Is that bad?
So are men.
Right. Okay. But I'm not saying it's bad. I said, is it bad? No, it's not bad. It's part of the contribution that women can make to a relationship, for men and women to come together.
But men are just as concerned about how they look.
Sure. But they don't have that as a primary aspect of their image.
Really?
Yeah. I'm looking around at. you look at teenage males, you know, and in some respects
they're very conscious of what they look.
John's only 10, and he's so concerned about his hair when it gets too long. He's forever
right.
Combing it, and he doesn't even like girls. I don't know, he's trying to impress a woman.
Yeah. Practicing. But I just think that I can't see that anybody would agree that that's more typical of men than women, or that it's both the same. I think it is much more typical of women than men.
They're more fashion conscious, maybe.
You think that? Are you speaking of what you add on to oneself, or you don't think that a lot of the bodybuilding and the physique and so on that men aren't conscious of?
Sure, but I think that that's relating more to other men, you know, in that epidiactic thing, you know, of they want, this is their own image of what they themselves think is beautiful, rather than what necessarily women think is beautiful.
I think women do the same thing, though, for other women. I mean, and not for women, but because there are women around.
But if you look at all the myths and legends, it's the women that are beautiful, the women that attract men.
Who wrote the men?
Men wrote them. That's what we do.
Men didn't write them.
That's why the cave of the he's always a gorgeous hunk of male specimen.
Well, I'm not denying that. But I'm saying that, think of some other archetypal characteristic. Like facilitating smooth social relationships. Men can do that too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not part of their archetypical image.
But I'm saying that it's so much more important to our, to women's identity to be attracted to males than it is for men's identity to be attracted to females, because men are a greater sphere of what's beautiful in terms of, you know, that's really character or something, you know, that might not be. Women aren't allowed that span of what's beautiful in the same way that men are allowed that huge span.
I think that's also a stereotype. I agree that that's true, George, but I also think that men want it that way. And they will preserve that at all costs.
I think
it's changing, and I don't think men like the change. Men, because that's another power play over women. You look nice for me.
Oh, okay.
That's the way I
right. want it. Okay, so, but I didn't get a chance to make my conclusion. My conclusion is that if women are going to, if women want to be able to, again, going back to this, choose their lives on their own, you find what happens a lot, like with the feminist movement, is that women start dressing in ways that are not attractive to men. And they don't use makeup, and they dress in general to cover themselves up to their necks, you know, and all parts of showing skin. Then, they just like an example of leaving the church, they can choose to come back to learn to be flirtatious and get all kinds of little psychological benefit from that and playing out that role. And you know, talking about facilitating social relationships. You know, have you ever noticed that, like in schools, junior high schools, and colleges, it's always the women that plan things and that run for student body offices because they be the planners. You know, maybe some man runs, but yeah, and the dances and things like that.
But they still elect the guy president and the woman secretary.
Yeah, and because, you know, the man is, you know, some traditional role is supposed to be the president. But, and when men are left to their own, they don't do a lot of planning for social affairs. They do a lot of things spontaneously. Or, like single men, will attach themselves to groups of females that plan things so that they can go along with it. Now, I'm not saying that men can't do that planning. But what I'm saying is that if we recognize what men individually can contribute to a relationship and what women can individually contribute to a relationship, like you were saying, Kevin, then we start getting in touch with those archetypal bases of our sexual identity.
Can or will.
Then we can say that we're bringing this, you know, something by our choice to a relationship to peculiarly enhance it for both parties.
One of the things I've noticed through personal experience, and I'm personally acquainted with women live in community, heterosexual women in an urban place live in a community of five or six women in one place where that they feel very appropriate doing that. But a lot of men don't feel as appropriate doing that. And I've inquired, because some of my friends do this, whether or not they're able to meet needs. Social needs, of course, are met because of the community, but also emotional needs, and whether people have to ask for those needs to be met, or if they're met through observation of the other people in that community. And I've noticed that men aren't quite as astute at recognizing the needs of other men as women might be. Women seem to be more.
Yeah. Before we, I think that's true. There's an example, you know, like how do men organize? The next step of what I wanted to get to is how do men organize themselves to take care of these things and learn these things. I've told some of you this. I was reading this interview with a Midwestern college dean, and he was saying that when freshman males apply to the fresh person males. Apply to the school. They sign up for co-ed dorms, you know, because they think, oh, my fantasy is going to be realized, you know, and I'm only a freshman. And so they come to school, you know, and then they discover that it's not what they expected. You know, like there's women telling them to pick up things. and that their rudeness or their vulgarity is not appreciated.